Real quick, before we get into the show, I wanted to share a new service called Getida that Ken and I have been using that has made us over $10,000 in Amazon reimbursements. The service requires no monthly subscription, and Getida collects a small percentage of the money they recover for you. It takes less than 5 minutes to set up and works on all Amazon marketplaces. Go to Getida.com, G-E-T-I-D-A, and enter promo code FTM400. That's FTM for firing the man 400 to get your first $400 in reimbursements commission free. How much money does Amazon owe you?
Trying to find a balance of a young workforce that kind of is coming in with the freshest and really not knowing what they're looking for. And then pairing that with craftsmanship of the older side of the workforce that they've seen it all and will be able to help find the pitfalls. How much easier is it to find a sourcing team that's going to work on a time window that is similar to what the rest of their family does versus, oh, good, at 7:30 at night every night, I start talking to China. I'm done talking to them about 3:30, and then I'm going to wake up and there's quality of life that goes with it too.
Welcome, everyone, to the Firing the Man podcast, a show for anyone who wants to be their own boss. If you sit in a cubicle every day and know you are capable of more, then join us. This show will help you build a business and grow your passive income streams in just a few short hours per day. And now your hosts, serial entrepreneurs David Schomer and Ken Wilson.
Welcome, everyone, to the Firing the Man podcast. On today's episode, we have the privilege to interview Jason Azevedo. Jason has had his heart in business development since an early age, starting a very successful apparel company that he grew from his humble beginnings in a garage to an annual gross billings of over $1 million by age 15. By age 18, Jason was doing millions in business with Starbucks, Nike, Disney, Marvel, Volkswagen, Audi, Lucasfilms, Dodgers, and countless NBA teams. In 2009, Jason co-founded Advoke, one of the only U.S.-based manufacturers located in Silicon Valley, California. His emphasis on Made in America is a driving force for how the various companies he's co-founded operate. Jason has worked on many key projects for companies such as Arista Networks, Best Buy, Costco, Disney, EA Games, Intel, Roku, Starbucks, Target, Walmart, and Warner Brothers. Rounding out the intro with a few of Jason's personal hobbies, he likes to ride dirt bikes, quads, beach volleyball, and whiskey tasting. Jason, we're really excited to have you on the show. And to start things off, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, first off, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to hang out today. My background's different than the regular path. It's like you mentioned, I started my first company at 15 years old. I was a sophomore in high school and thought, you know, it's a great idea. Let's get into the realm of business. And how is that going to function? But I also kind of have to set the stage of the moment in time and the factors that are coming together for this. I grew up in a factory house. My father worked graveyard 28, 29 years for the same company in a manufacturing plant. And that company was the epitome of what you think of as a bad manufacturing job. The management was frankly constantly at the throat of the manufacturing level employees. It just wasn't a healthy environment. Now, granted, that was one of the most profitable plants in the country for the company that my father worked, but they still laid off all the employees in the final 6 to 7 years he worked there just about as many times. So my brother and I grew up seeing that. And when we started our first manufacturing company, it was a huge point of ours was it didn't have to be like that. We believed that there was a way to go into manufacturing and truly bring it back to what it was when it was in its heyday and kind of the strength and that development. So we started an apparel company, and it was interesting because we started it in February of 2007. Well, here comes the end of 2007 and early 2008, and everybody knows what suddenly happens to every market in the country. And everybody's telling us it's not the time to start a business. It's horrible. It's you guys don't know what you're doing. You're not going to get clients, everything under the sun. There's just everyone's telling us it's going to be horrible and it's going to fail. And one person messed up. I distinctly remember the conversation, and they go, "You're going to lose everything you have." And it took me back because you got to remember, I'm 15 years old. I have $600. Like, what is this person talking about? And it clicked that what it was, It was every person around us telling us why they weren't doing it, why they hadn't done it, why they were afraid. And none of it had to do with us. We were young, stupid kids that we had nothing but energy and drive. So we just decided to jump into business. Well, a down economy does something really interesting. And we learned by fire. All of a sudden, all the equipment to do manufacturing is now pennies on the dollar because people are going out of business left and right. And giant clients that you never would have been able to get into as a small company, their manufacturer had just suddenly gone defunct because they were having cash flow problems, but they still have orders they need to fill. So you've got these massive clients that people would kill to get into that we're getting into because they're trying to find out where to go and the world's changing and they want to be a big fish to anyone they go to because they want to be able to ride the storm with them. So we started collecting these great clients and great opportunities, sheerly built out of what everyone was telling us was going to fail. So it was a very just different moment in time where you learned business at what everyone else was says the worst time. And we till this day argue is the best thing that ever happened to us.
That's awesome. And that's a like super powerful story too. Like at 15, like, hey, I'm going to, you know, everybody telling you not to do something. And then you go and decide to do. And a lot of this, what you said makes sense. Like, you know, market downturn, everything is going away and it's a perfect opportunity for someone that wants to come in and solve problems and be nimble and pivot. So that's awesome. So Jason, your background a little is in manufacturing, right? So manufacturing expert, let's get into, you know, probably back towards when you started, kind of what's the history?
Yeah. So there's a stigma that comes with manufacturing where everybody thinks it's old. And anybody who's not in the space has this mentality that for some reason, manufacturing plants in their heads are still Charles Dickens with dirt floor and machine grease flying everywhere and people's arms getting ripped off. And that's not the case anymore. It's that, frankly, factories have come a long way, especially in the last 10 years. When we started, our primary focus was people forward. How do you build plants that you can take care of people and, frankly, add in the tools to make the people more effective? So that was a huge core focus of ours, really building off of a lot of what Toyota had done in kind of in the late 80s, early 90s, really a lot of the lean manufacturing ideas, but then taking it to that next level of how do you use that to make the most effective workforce you can and the most, and also to have the ability to have iteration. Because nowadays, one of the most important things in manufacturing is your ability to iterate on the same design, because products are ever changing. They're very difficult. It's very unoften that the same product stays the same product for any significant period of time anymore. There's constantly adjustments being made. I'll give a kind of an example. I'm very fortunate on my team. I have a lot of early Tesla employees, and till this day or on the Tesla production lines, during breaks, the engineers are sitting there waiting because they want to go measure things on the cars. And, hey, we might make a change on this flange. And it's happening almost in real time during production days. So we've spent a lot of focus on how do you maintain that ability to produce a consistent, good product, but also how to iterate and how to keep with the times and flow. And there's a good combination of technology and automation and skill set training that we work with our people to make sure that they've got all of those things added up to really have the best fighting chance to move forward.
If you want tips and strategies on how to start, grow, and monetize your business online, check out the Digital Revolution podcast with Eli Adams. We interview digital experts from around the world that share their personal stories. They talk about what they're currently working on and where they see the future going. But most importantly, they share tactics in their specific area of expertise with the hope of helping you improve your digital presence online. You can listen to the Digital Revolution podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, or simply click on the link in the show notes below.
Okay. Very nice. That's an interesting story about the Tesla employees and them chomping at the bit to get back. So, you know, as part of manufacturing, supply chains is a big topic. And so can we talk about your experiences with supply chains in 2022?
Yeah. So I believe that you're going to see a regionalization of supply chains again. I think, like any pendulum, the world manufacturing market and world supply chain market went from super, super isolationist, say 50, 60 years ago, to everybody decided to go to the other direction with the pendulum and go super global base. Let's go after the lowest wage workers, whatever, and really kind of broke that chain. And I think you're going to see a balance come back, and you are seeing it happen already, where a regional sets of manufacturers that are closer to the final consumer and cut down on shipping costs, really have a better insight to the local consumer, provide jobs in that region so that you can create your own internal consumers. That's really what we're starting to see in this next phase. And one of the big important things that's happened is for about 20, 30 years ago in the manufacturing space and the supply chain in general, low-cost labor was the primary driver of why you'd manufacture most products in a certain place or another. And with the technological boom that has been the last 10 to 15 years, the manufacturing space has also seen that same boom. So what you're starting to see is now you don't have to go chase the lowest wage. You actually are looking for the most competent worker, the most competent workforce. And that usually provides a really good positioning for American manufacturing because we can have more skilled, more well-paid, more well-taken care of employees doing functional jobs because the automation is making the effectiveness and taking out the monotony of what you normally do.
Dive in on the people side of things. And for those of you that have listened to our show, you're probably well aware we started a manufacturing facility in 2021. And what we're finding is that the right people make things a lot easier. And so do you have any pro tips on where do these people hang out? How do you find them?
Okay. So there's a couple things. First off, manufacturing is a people business. Every industry tries to say it is. There is no industry that is as much a people business as manufacturing. It's a special world because frankly, so much of it has to do with man hours and craftsmanship. And really, how do you dive in there? We like to have a healthy balance of people that we've built ourselves. And frankly, that way we can instill the values and the focus that we like. Also taking into account trying to find a balance of a young workforce that kind of is coming in with the freshest and really not knowing what they're looking for. And then pairing that with craftsmanship of the older side of the workforce that they've seen it all and will be able to help find the pitfalls. And really it's a blend. So I hear a lot of people with manufacturing teams that they're like, oh, I'm looking for this type of person. It's like, no, where it's really successful, at least in our history, has been, how do I combine somebody who might be jaded and very stuck in their ways and combine them on a respect level with somebody who wants to change everything and believes that they have all these great new ideas and get those two people to respect each other enough to listen to each other and to work together. And then that's what gives you that blend of forward progress, but also the infrastructure and stability of a new plant.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I definitely agree. Like, it's definitely a people business. I mean, that's the kind of the lifeblood of getting everything done, right? So Jason, like kind of moving on, like in the last, say, I don't know, two or three decades, it just seems like manufacturing, at least from my view, it's like everything is like, we kind of offshored everything, you know, EPA, there's all these rules that comes up and it's cheaper elsewhere. Like you alluded to earlier, labor hours, you know, there's certain parts in Asia that labor hours are super, super cheap. And so we've offshored a lot year over year for the last few decades, manufacturing to China, mostly into a few other countries. Now, I think COVID was like a significant like blip on the radar. Everything shut down. And we realized like here in the US, we realized like we couldn't get like masks. We couldn't get, there are certain things we couldn't get. And it was, oh wow, this happened. We're kind of single threaded here. We're relying on other people. COVID since, you know, has been in the decline. And I think there's just been this new energy in manufacturing. Can you kind of speak to that a little bit, like revitalizing manufacturing?
Yeah. So you hit on something that is incredibly important, and that is COVID's effect on this. So for the last 10 to 15 years, a fallacy has been being accepted within the US. And that is that it is automatically more expensive to produce in the US or automatically cheaper to produce in a low wage country. If you went back 25, 30 years, you're correct. The reality is the American manufacturing infrastructure was doing things the way they'd done it for 40, 50 years. And then all of a sudden, an extraordinarily low wage country comes online. And they couldn't compete one-to-one. It's simple as that. So it became cheaper to produce offshore. But where the fallacy comes in is that people are still thinking that way. Even though we have had the most incredible technological advances in the last 15 years, and we see them in every other industry, but for some reason, people don't correlate that with the manufacturing industry. When I was in high school, my teacher always told me, you have to learn how to do the math on paper because you're not going to have a calculator in your pocket every day. Well, my teacher was wrong.
Don't tell my son that.
But this is happening everywhere. Yeah. But this happened everywhere, and it happened in the manufacturing industry too, is things got easier. We needed less monotonous labor hours. So the concept of we're fighting labor hour to labor hour isn't true anymore. Because the automation in a low-wage country and automation in the U.S., they produce the same thing. So now you've got transportation costs. You've got opportunity costs of having a lot of product out. And companies started to realize that. But everyone was afraid to test it. Years ago, Apple had written a report that they could, under certain structures, they could produce the iPhone cheaper in the U.S. than they could in China. And there were a couple barriers to entry, but everyone was afraid to test it. It needed a catalyst for people to be forced to test it. Enter COVID. The world starts shutting down. And you've got supply chain managers who have been looking out the corner of their eye going, this is possible. I think it makes sense to go in the US. But everyone was afraid to test. And then all of a sudden, the world told them, you must test this idea. And they started testing it and they're like, wow, it actually worked. Hey, this is fiscally responsible. In addition to that, one of the scariest things is the last people to catch on to it are American entrepreneurs. We, XCON, just bought a facility in Ohio to help build the Fisker. I mean, that is the premier Chinese contract manufacturer. And they're going, we're going to build those parts in the US. I mean, just think about that. So we're starting to see a lot of other countries come in and go, oh yeah, this makes total sense. We'll totally build a plant here. And it took COVID for a lot of people to be forced to look into it. And as soon as they looked into it, started going, wow, this is actually penciling out. Hey, I'm getting my life back. My engineers love it because instead of working all night to talk to foreign sources, they're just going to a plant in Indiana and looking at what's being done. So that really that moment in time that COVID created was really important. And we had been saying it for years that it was going to take something to finally make people realize it. And we always thought it was going to be some major corporation that decided to try it and it worked out. Well, come to find out, it was the world stopping for a year.
Absolutely. We've said it on here before, but manufacturing in the USA will always be in style and it'll always be cool. It's just something that, when Ken and I talk about what we do, one thing we almost always bring up is our manufacturing facility because it's cool. We're making stuff here. It's awesome. And so I'm going to make a statement right now and I'll let you know I don't agree with this, but I'd like you to take the other side of this. And that statement is I'm a person on fixed income and I am buying, say, like a baby product online and I can buy it from a USA manufacturer for $25 or I can buy it from a Chinese manufacturer for $15. I do like supporting things that are made in the USA, but given my fixed income, I'm going with the lower priced option. Can you take the other side of that?
Well, I think there's a fallacy in the premise. Why automatically is the foreign thing cheaper? That isn't the reality anymore. The reality is oftentimes when something's more expensive because it's made in the US, it's because it's a marketing game. You can charge more. It's an American-made product. But the numbers have lined up on a P&L over the past 10 years. But there is still something premium to be said about it's American-made. I will tell you, a lot of products that boast American-made are made in the same factory with products that don't boast American made. So you might actually be buying the product without even knowing you're buying it. In addition to that, there is something about American products that have a warranty that goes along with it, and they stand by them. And there's something to be said about that. Is you, I know a lot of your listeners are very Amazon based. The difference between calling an American supplier and calling it a foreign supplier with, hey, half of this product is scratched coming in, your response rate's just a little bit higher on the domestic side. So really, it's understanding that. But there's a huge problem with just the concept of, oh, it's automatically cheaper because it might be foreign. That's just not something that's held true.
I think it's a really good point and definitely a fallacy within that statement. I am sure there is somebody listening to this podcast who is sourcing from China. And you've talked about kind of penciling it out. And so when someone is going through this exercise, do I source foreign or do I make it domestic? What are some of the things that they should be penciling in? Like shipping is the obvious one, but like, what are some other things?
Shipping, tariffs, I mean, all of that makes baseline sense. One of the big ones is carrying cost. So you're going to buy 50,000 products. Well, you're going to, if you place an order for 50,000 products, and we're going to use China for the fun of it, you are going to put 50% down no matter what. You're going to wire them that to start the order. However long it takes to run that order, they're going to hold 50% of your money. Before they will even look at writing a BOL or putting it on a container, you're going to wire them the rest of the money because there's not going to be terms on these things. Then you're going to put them on a boat because you really don't want to put them on the airplane and get them in 5 to 7 days because you're going to eat up way too much shipping. So let's say you put them on a boat. So now you're weeks without knowing if that product you've bought is good. You've got the carrying cost of all that product. Whether you're using a line of credit to hold that note or anything else, you now, your cash flow is messed up because you can't release consistently enough. Then you've got all this carrying cost. It gets to you. Now, if there's an issue, because there's always an issue. And this is whether you're domestic or you're foreign, wherever you're sourcing from, you're going to run into it. So now how many weeks to correct that issue? Because it's been on the water for 3-4 weeks and it got stuck in the port of Long Beach for another 2 or 3. And then, okay, well, now we need to correct it. So it's a rebuild. What did that do to your Amazon listing? Because you actually haven't had product that can be sold on it in now 12 weeks by the time you get something in there. So that damage ratio is there. And the reality is, if you look at what Tim Cook did at Apple, really what, because he was the one who brought Apple's supply chain to the next level. He took their on-hand inventory, using foreign sources still. He took their on-hand inventory from months to 6 days because that carrying cost was such a dangerous cost for the company. So he shortened that as tight as he could. Well, a lot of people, when they're looking at stuff just on penciling, they're not looking at all the risk that you're adding in by having these massive carrying days. The next one is iteration. If you've got a product that you're adapting, changing, you're responding to Amazon reviews, you're responding to anything else, that time to make sure that you've got that next iteration there, the more you can shorten that up, the more you can get to a product that can sell faster. So it cuts down on that marketing and development expense. Of course, damage ratios are very important. Take even the iPhone. If you look up the stats on how many iPhones are bricks and have to be returned a year, is unbelievable. You're still sitting at 3-7% at their level. It's crazy. So really, you need to look into all of that width of stuff. But then we go back to your people too. Say you've got a sourcing team. How much easier is it to find a sourcing team that's going to work on a time window that is similar to what the rest of their family does versus, oh, good, at 7:30 at night every night, I start talking to China. I'm done talking to them about 3:30, and then I'm going to wake up and there's quality of life that goes with it too. So really, it's taking a broader view of it. Now, if you're trying to get into the commodities business and, well, I'm going to buy this one thing, 5,000 of them, I don't care about the quality, put them up, hope they sell, move on. Okay, maybe you start going out, you start simplifying it. But if you're truly building a business out of it, you got to look at all of the costs and the opportunity costs and the carrying costs. Those kind of things are where things really get crazy.
There's a lot of good points. And yeah, some of them you don't really think of, like, or you don't like compare apples to apples, like the carrying cost and the cash flow. That's something you really don't. I think it's, at least for me, like on paper, it doesn't hit you until you're in that process, until you need that cash to buy a second order. And then you're like, I don't have any cash, right? And so those are all really good points, you know, if you're looking at pros and cons. So no, those are awesome. Yeah, looking at it from a 10,000 foot view.
Sorry to interrupt the episode. You may have heard Ken and I talking recently about a new tool that we're using for Amazon refunds. Now, I have used other refund tools like this. However, I can tell you in the first 7 days, they scrubbed the back end of my Amazon account going back 18 months and found $5,000 of refunds. And the nice thing about this is it's my money. Amazon made a mistake and they are just auditing my account. The other thing I really like about this tool is there is no monthly fee. They only charge a commission if they are successful in getting you your money. Go to Getida.com, G-E-T-I-D-A, and enter promo code FTM for Firing the Man, FTM400. This is an awesome tool. Can't say enough good things about it. Now, back to the episode.
Now, so if everything is the same, so like American manufacturing versus China, let's just stay on that. How can American manufacturers kind of keep up with Chinese manufacturers, you know, given that, let's say, everything was equal? Like, how do we compete with them?
I never look at it as us versus them. There is so much work to go around. You don't need to compete. If you can manufacture in the US and you can keep efficient, every person I talk to is so backlogged, it's unbelievable. And the reason being is we're consuming faster. There just sheerly are not enough people making things to keep up with how fast this world wants it. And frankly, you look at like developing economies like China or like India, they're starting to consume all of their own products. Like at some point, you just need to make more. You take a razor, go back 20, 30, 40 years, people would actually sharpen razors. Now we have four blades on a razor. We use it one time, throw it away because it's disposable, get another one. So you take something that may have lasted you for years. Now we're using one every day. So its consumption rate is drastic. I think it's something that's hard for Americans to understand because we've been consuming a lot for a long time. But as other developing economies are coming online, you've got a world of people who were at the lower end of consumption and they're starting to move up the ladder and they're starting to get more products to them. And we're not ready to feed all those people with products. So I never look at it as, hey, it's us against them or that. And there are certain things that make more sense to make in other regions. I'm all about regional manufacturing, make sure it's local in the community in the US, because that's what I understand. But there are things that make sense to make in other places. And I can simplify it like, hey, maybe wooden clogs, the US isn't the number one place to make and sell those. There's probably a couple other countries that make more sense. So it's understanding what makes the most sense in that region. And if you look at it that way, that there really is never a, hey, we're fighting to grow. Pretty much every customer of every American manufacturer, as long as they're good at what they do, is begging them to produce more stuff. Because right now the US consumes the most products, so you're going to want to make them as close to the people consuming.
If you're a podcast host or someone wanting to be interviewed on podcasts as a guest, visit podmatch.com. Podmatch automatically connects ideal podcast guests and hosts together for interviews. We always say it works just like a dating app, but instead of connecting you for dates, it connects you for podcast interviews. Podmatch has connected over 85,000 guests and hosts together for interviews that listeners love, all while saving you countless hours of administrative work through built-in automations. If you're ready to level up your podcast interviews on either side of the mic, start today by visiting podmatch.com.
Let's dive into raw materials and sourcing those. And my question, and I'm going to give a little background on this, is what types of materials does the U.S. have a strategic advantage with? And my example would be like, say you're making a face cream out of coffee beans, like being based in Colombia, where most of the coffee comes from. would be a huge advantage. And so certainly there are raw materials in the US that we have a surplus of or could potentially source more efficiently. And so any thoughts on?
Yeah. So, I mean, the reality is the US has a really good stronghold on plastics. We're plastics and steel. It's kind of been our thing that we're strong there. But I've always felt that the concept of build near the raw material is completely just insane. It is so much easier to move something in its raw form than after we've converted it, added it. Like think of a Lego brick. How much easier is it to move the resin for the brick than all of the air inside of that Lego brick? It is drastically easier to source raw materials from a place that has them and take them to where you're going to make the final product. Yet for some reason, for a long time, people have been moving the manufacturing to the raw material. And it's like, wait, no, they're drastically easier to move when they're in their raw form. So it's, I think there's just a change that's going on. And you're starting to see it with a lot more areas. Because what happened in, say, let's go back 100 years. The reason why we saw manufacturers next to the raw material wasn't because they went near the raw material. It was some guy who had a lot of coffee beans because he happens to be in Colombia and goes, the hell am I going to do with all these coffee beans? And decided to make a face cream. People got used to that pattern and started thinking, oh, I want to be near my raw material. It's like, no, these people just happen to have them. So they started doing things with them. As products are getting more complex, the likelihood of being next to all of your raw materials is zero. You're not going to make a product that is efficient to every raw material that happens to be in the zone that you're in. So really what's shifting now is where the commodities markets for these raw materials become more and more effective to bring them to where we want to manufacture, not the other way around.
Yeah, fair enough. And that's a good point too on, you know, moving the raw materials in the raw form versus shipping air. I'm at the bar that one. So next question I have for you, Jason, you know, so for anybody listening to, you know, to the episode, how hard is it to start manufacturing? Let's say you're an entrepreneur and let's pick up plastics. Cause you mentioned, you know, US is, we're pretty dominant on plastics. Let's say they're selling, you know, plastic cups in Walmart and Amazon. They got a kind of a small business. And then they're kind of interested in like self-manufacturing or even finding a manufacturer here in the US. What's that process look like? And is it, how hard is it?
Of course, it comes down to the complexity of the product. But I will say manufacturing is a very certain skill set and is not starting your own manufacturing plant is not smooth. It's not easy. It's usually contrary. It takes fighting a lot of internal belief systems that you have or things that feel like they should work this way or that. But it's also not impossible. So you look at like nanotechnology, starting in nanotechnology is, it's almost impossible. It's such a level out there that you can't touch it. You can start a manufacturer and it's just going to take work and lots of it. The other part of it is, and that we've always been huge proponents of, you've got to share information. If you go through it thinking everything you're doing is so proprietary, that you hold everything to your chest, you will have no friends, nobody will help you, and it's going to hurt. And you look at Tesla, I mean, realistically, the only major car company that started in the last 100 years. And Elon came out and just gave all of their information to everybody. Said, hey, here's all my patents. Here's how we're doing it. Because you almost have to. You have to have that level of openness to really drive forward. Because it is, the barrier to entry is hard. It's not impossible. And that is what's really important is if you're willing to put the work in, you can start a manufacturing company. You want to find that balance we talked about earlier of kind of the jaded, old, this is the way we do it. We've done it this for 70 years and the, but can we try it like this? Let's do that. Let's play with this. And if you can balance those correctly, it simplifies the process drastically.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, one follow-up question I have is for people that are manufacturing in the USA or they're sourcing products that are manufactured in the USA. What are some ways that they can, one, get that message out to their customers? And are there any, I've heard of like websites that like only sell made in the USA products. So we, as I mentioned, we recently started manufacturing in the USA, and we'd love to tell our customers about it. And we do in product inserts and whatnot. But what are some other ways you can kind of leverage that and use that to your advantage?
So we'll start domestically, and then we'll kind of keep on growing outwards. But domestically, of course, just mention it a lot. I mean, people will gravitate towards it. And it doesn't have to be like, made in America is the best. It's, hey, we're proudly made in America, America providing the one that goes a lot for, at least for me and for a lot of the people I work with, providing 100 American jobs in such and such town in Kansas. Because that's really what a lot of people are going to care about, is that the impact of doing it in the U.S., not just because it's being done in the U.S. Really, what is that? What is the company to the community that it's in? Hey, we're out of Wichita Falls. So Wichita Falls Little League, sponsored by our company. So that's really what it means. Cause when American buys an American product, oftentimes they're holding on to the belief and the love of what that means to the community of the U.S., not just, hey, it's an American made product. One of the things that I always warn people about when they're saying they're American-made products, they harp on it too much as, well, it must be better because it's American. And it's like, the reality is the iPhone is one of the most impressive devices in history, and it's not American-made. So you can't just use it as synonymous, because frankly, people disbelieve it. It's really about, how does it help people? Now, if you're going to take your American-made product and you're going to go outside of the U.S., this is where it becomes cool. The U.S. Department of Commerce will help you. They will, if you can tell them that I'm making it in the U.S., I'm an American company, they will actually get involved and help you export it, help you understand the communities you're going to. I've heard of them helping set up trade shows for companies that are going to other countries. The SBA has export loan programs for American-made products. So really, that there's, if you start looking outside American borders with American products, the U.S. government does largely help try to get those to the markets, because they understand it's hard to compete on a global scale when you're a smaller man.
For those of our listeners that are driving, we're going to post links to that in the show notes. Second one you mentioned would be SBA.gov. What was the first one that you mentioned?
U.S. Department of Commerce.
Okay, we'll post links to that.
Yeah, and that you have local offices throughout the U.S. We've worked with them a couple of times. I've heard great things about other friends working with them, that they really just kind of come in and go, hey, how can we support you? Because we know it takes support to go to that global scale.
Have you, kind of going on this topic, have you heard of any like grant-type programs or seed capital for people that are, you know, starting a manufacturing firm?
Yeah, so... what I do nowadays is I run a private equity fund that is called MRCA. We go out and buy legacy U.S. manufacturing companies and make sure that they stay in those local communities and grow them and add that extra energy and that oomph that they need to get to that next level. And we actually were looking at a company about 6 months ago, and they got a $1 million grant to buy a new machine, because some U.S. grant department decided that they wanted more of this type of manufacturing in the U.S. And they were able to go there and prove, hey, if I buy this machine, I'm going to add this many people's jobs. And they did the whole grant application, and the government handed them the money, handed them the machine, and said, here you go. So there's tons of stuff like that. There's all sorts of programs that you can go into. It is specific to your product, your industry, and the kind of the niche that you're in, but really look into it, because there is a lot of support.
Yeah, that's awesome. I want to circle back on one point that you made earlier, Jason. It was, you know, David asked a question about the made in USA and then, you know, how do you leverage that? And that you made a really strong point that, you know, I don't think consumers are buying a made in USA product for quality. You know, you give the example of the iPhone. I totally agree. It's one of the best devices ever. I think it's the notion of that they want to know that they're supporting and helping others. I think that's what a lot of people want. Yeah. And so in order to like build that connection, I think it's a point that's often missed. And I really like your analogy where like, hey, you know, this product was made in this small town community by these 100 people, and it supported their community. That is incredible. And it's a way to build that connection and kind of like a bond. And then that consumer knows that, hey, I'm helping out and this is my way to help out is to do that. So I really like that. So you touched on any, Jason and David, any other questions or any other topics we want to talk to before we kind of pivot into MRCA?
Yeah, one last question. So this is for our listeners. This is also for us. For anyone that is in manufacturing and we'll call them level one, like just getting into it and they want to get to level 10, what would be some practical suggestions for, you know, stepping up our game or to our listeners who are manufacturing for them to step up their game?
So if you're going to get into manufacturing, you need to go buy a book called The Toyota Way. It is kind of the entrance to anybody who's doing modern manufacturing. If you go into any of us that have war stories from doing these plants or any of that kind of stuff, we all have a copy in our office. It's kind of the go-to starter book. And what it does is it explains the transition that happened in manufacturing 20, 30 years. That start there because it starts breaking your stigma of how it should work. The other one, make friends, share information. The amount of people I talk to, they're, this is proprietary. I can't share it. Oh, okay. I mean, I'm pretty sure you didn't reinvent one of the oldest industries in the world, but hey, sure. Whatever you did. So it is about sharing information. It's really about helping each other. And the other one of it is get really good at saying, I don't know how to do. Because once you can do that, what we force any person that we or any plant that we're taking over that we're starting to work with, I force them to explain their process in linear steps. And usually it'll be like 25 steps and we'll try to get them down to 4 or 5. And there's no way we do all this custom work and it's this and that. Okay. Then let's start figuring out how to get it that simple. Cause once you simplify it, it becomes similar to being a decent cook. If you take a decent cook and you give them pretty much any recipe, they're going to make it taste good. That's what a good manufacturer will do. They'll take the recipe from the engineer. They've got the baseline understanding of how the process works of manufacturing, and they will execute on that recipe and make the product well. Any person who's like, well, that's not how it works. I'm only a pastry chef. Yeah, that's not modern manufacturing. You need to be way more well-rounded nowadays.
Awesome. Yeah, those are excellent tips. I definitely wrote some notes down here. Very cool. Appreciate that. Awesome. So want to pivot into RCA. So you had mentioned it briefly earlier, Jason. So can you share with the audience, you know, what does MRCA stand for and kind of explain a little bit about it?
Yeah. So MRCA stands for the Manufacturing Revitalization Corporation of America. It's a mouthful. We totally understand it is, but it was important for us to have each one of the words in it. And really the one I harp on is revitalization. The U.S. manufacturing got kicked for quite some time. And we've gone over talking today, the influence of low wage countries. We've gone into kind of some of the other stuff that's gotten in the way. And what's happened is a lot of people have not gone into manufacturing. It's rare to find a younger person coming up through the companies. So what's happening is we have a set of ownership in the manufacturing space that's aging out. They're usually going to be baby boomers, usually second, third generation company, and there's nobody to buy these companies. So what happens when they shut down? So what we do at MRCA, we search the country constantly for, they have to be good, they have to be profitable, strong infrastructure, extreme resiliency, and usually ownership that has a ton of excess opportunity in front of them, but they're tired. They don't want to execute on it this next phase. They don't want to go add in automation or process. They've got a very healthy company that's got good infrastructure, and they're frankly just riding the wave until they figure out how they're going to exit. So we come in, we buy the companies, tune them, put them all together, make sure they stay in that local community that they're in. Take the years of infrastructure and foundation work this company has, and then overlay modern equipment, modern opportunities, interconnect the companies, really whatever we can find that adds value to these companies. And then about 5 to 7 years in, we're taking the entire portfolio nationwide and we're going to transfer 100% of the ownership to the employees through an employee stock ownership program. So those local employees in those local communities will control that those factories stay in those local communities, basically until they choose that they don't. And that was the goal, is let's take this industry that's strong, that's healthy, really got these great companies. Let's just strengthen them a little bit more, put them all together, and then let's actually let the American factory worker own this factory.
That's awesome. That is awesome. And like, as you lay it out, really a novel idea. I mean, you hear of these businesses that, oh, my kids don't want to go into the business, so I don't know what I'm going to do. And yeah, you're right. They, you know, oftentimes if they have to shut down, their job's lost. And man, the kicker at the end when you turn it over to an employee stock option. That's so cool. I don't know. That fires me up. That fires me up. It's exciting.
We're excited by it. And through the general partners, when we sat down to frankly create MRCA, we all sat and we had long discussions. And the discussions all came back to, why are we doing this? Like, what is the true purpose? Because all of us have been in enough plants where all of us know how to build a manufacturing company. We know how to turn one around, and it does start to lose its shine eventually. And finally, we all just hit on, like, because it's going to do a lot of good. So we're like, you know what? Then let's take it a step further and make sure it does a hell of a lot of good. And that was the goal. It's these communities that we get the wonderful opportunity that I get to go see a lot of these companies, even if we don't buy them. We look at probably 100 to buy one or two. In all reality, these are not, it's a lot of groundwork. We like to go see as many plants as we can, but you get to see how cool some of these small communities are, where they've got, you're in town and they've got the local rodeo, or they've got this or that, and really starting to understand how diverse and kind of cool the quilt of the US is. Because the example I give everybody is, we've got plants. So if I take a plant that's in Texas and a plant in California, completely different. And everybody thinks, oh, okay, here's the baseline reasons why you're going to be different. I'm like, no, okay, we've got all the stuff that comes to your head. Put that out, put that aside. In California, on Friday night during high school football season, I ask somebody to work, unless their kid plays on the team. They're like, yeah, I would love to have a Friday night shift. You do the same thing in rural Texas, you can actually ruin somebody's social circle, because that's where they go see all their friends every week. So understanding that little difference, like scheduling on a Friday night during a certain window of the year, completely changes it. And that's what we find so cool, is you've got just this, every community truly is its own special thing. And we try to get in there. And one of the things we ask sellers at the close or during our due diligence, what don't I know and make sense to you because you live here? And they're like, oh, no, it's just a typical place and stuff. And we're talking to one and he goes, well, except for don't ask anybody to work after 2:30 at this plant. And we're like, why not? Well, because the only reason why you'd ever live in that town is because you're either a big time hunter or a big time fisherman. And if you keep the plant open after 2:30, they can't go hunting or fishing that day. You go, so they're like, yeah, so you can bring them in at 1 a.m, but everyone's out by 2:30. And we're like, we wouldn't have known that. And like that same plant, he goes, oh yeah. And company paid holidays on the first 2 days of every hunting season. And we're like, why? What? He goes, because if you schedule people to work, they can show up anyways. So you might as well get the day off and shut the plant. So it's really what it is. So MRCA, from a business side, yeah, we're going after profitable companies. The goal's always to expand and make them bigger, more profitable, add more workforce, add more function, but also do that so that community's got this stronger and stronger staple. We were looking at a company the other day. They employed more people than the population of the town that their headquarters is in. You look up this city that they're in, and the company's name pops up on Google, not the name of the town. So just think about the impact you can have if you're strengthening that. And that's what MRCA really was focused on and is focused on, how to strengthen.
That's awesome. This is an incredible story. I really like, I know we're coming up on time. I'd really like to, follow your story and then have you back on in a few years and kind of see and watch this kind of develop. It's very powerful, very impactful. And I really like it. Definitely want to squeeze in. We have what's called the fire round for every podcast guest. So we send them through the ringer. Are you ready, Jason?
Oh, here we go.
All right. What is your favorite book?
Great Gatsby.
What are your hobbies?
I live on a ranch, so ranch work, I guess, is about my hobby.
Nice. What is the one thing that you do not miss about working for the man?
I've never actually worked for another person.
That's awesome. So you started your first one at 15, awesome.
I've never actually worked for somebody.
That's awesome. So no answer on number three. NA, we'll mark it NA, right? Next one. What do you think sets apart successful entrepreneurs from those who give up, fail, or never get started?
You are going to get kicked. You are going to get knocked down. You get back up and do it again.
That's awesome. David, you want to close out the show?
Yeah, Jason, if people want to get a hold of you or learn more about Advoke or MRCA, what would be the best way to do that?
Best way is go to mrca.net. If you're interested in investing with us, there is a link there for accredited investors. You can look at that. You can look at what we're doing, look at our team. If you have questions regarding MRCA, regarding manufacturing that you've got, that you're thinking about doing, about a cookie recipe, on there is a link to get time directly on my personal calendar. I'm, like I said multiple times during the show, we're all about sharing information. We leave ourselves open. All the general partners for MRCA have a link there. You can set time. Get it on there. We'll sit down and talk about whatever you want to talk about. Please feel free to use it. We actually do really appreciate just talking to people about, hey, I've got this idea, or I ran into this problem, or hey, I really like chocolate chip cookies. Whatever it is, we'll sit and talk.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the Firing Man podcast, and looking forward to staying in touch and following your story.
Awesome. Thanks. And thanks for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to today's Firing the Man podcast. If you like this episode, head on over to firingtheman.com and check out our resource library for exclusive Firing the Man discounts on popular e-commerce subscription services. That is firingtheman.com/resource. You can also find a comprehensive library of over 50 books that Ken and I have read in the last few years that have made a meaningful impact on our business. For that, head on over to www.firingtheman.com/library. Lastly, check us out on social media at Firing the Man and on YouTube at Firing the Man for exclusive content. This is David Schomer
and Ken Wilson.
We're out. Before you go, we wanted to share a new service that Ken and I have been using called Getida that has made us over $10,000 in Amazon reimbursements. The service requires no monthly subscription, and Getida collects a small percentage of the money they recover for you. It takes less than 5 minutes to set up and works on all Amazon marketplaces. Go to Getida.com, G-E-T-I-D-A.com, and enter promo code FTM400. That's FTM for Firing the Man 400 to get your first $400 in reimbursements commission free. How much money does Amazon owe you?